Well, let me add my welcome to Tom. It's really good to see you here at this lunchtime. I know we've got a few people here for the first time. My name is Chris Fishlock, and part of the leadership team with Tom here at the London Bridge Talks. And I hope you really enjoy our time together. Do keep that passage in John 9 open. It'd be useful just to have your eyes on that as we go through this text. And the piece of paper you're given on the way in has some points that we'll be making through the talk today. When my children, who are now all adults, were younger, particularly between the age of sort of 5 and 15, that sort of age, a couple of times a year we'd go to a big house in the country where we would play a game called Colditz. Colditz is a very simple sort of premise. The idea of Colditz was to get from point A to point B, a point buried deep in the back of the garden to the front of the garden. This house in the country was sort of far enough away from cities and sort of light pollution to be relatively pitch black as long as there wasn't a full moon, and the children could hide unseen. A couple of us adults would have torches, and we would shine the torch around trying to find the children as they sort of crept through the undergrowth, trying to get themselves to the house before they were seen. And sometimes, of course, the light would catch them right full on in the face, sometimes right in their eyes. We had quite powerful torches. And, of course, it would leave them completely unable to see. Light can be like that, can't it? Light can be something that both illuminates and blinds. And the fascinating thing about this passage in John chapter 9 is that Jesus does both of those things. That's why he describes himself as he does. Look at the middle of verse 5, that bit that John, that Tom just read in John. I am the light of the world. What we're going to see in chapter 9, Jesus quite literally giving sight to the blind, revealing things that can't otherwise be seen. Light does that. But also, and perhaps this will shock some of you, we're going to see that Jesus actually blinds people, removing people's sight. That's going to be our primary subject next week as we look at this chapter in two halves. So we're going to have to think very carefully about that. They'll be open to a lot of misunderstandings. Both ideas, though, just so you know, it's not in my head, both ideas are summed up in a verse at the end of the chapter. Just glance down. We didn't read this just now. Verse 39. Jesus says, "For judgment I came into the world, that those who do not see may see, and those who see may become blind." Lots of, pardon me, too many chips on the way in. Lots of important details in this story, and you'll see them on the handout, some of the points I'm going to draw attention to. The first point there, the blind man. Point one, a picture of humanity. Just glance back at verse one again. As he passed by, he saw a man blind from birth, and his disciples asked him, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" Jesus answered, "It was not that this man sinned or his parents, but that the works of God might be displayed in him." Now, we know very little about this man. No name, just that he's blind. And then look at the end of verse 8, one other little detail there. He was a beggar. Interestingly, this unnamed beggar is going to be, look at verse 3, end of verse 3 there, somebody in whom the works of God might be displayed in him. In other words, Jesus says this individual is some sort of vehicle to show those who were present, and by extension us as readers, the works of God, an example of what God does to broken humanity. It's interesting also, as you look on to verse 14, that Jesus chooses to heal this individual on a Sabbath, something that was obviously going to rile the religious order of the day. And something that, of course, reminds us as readers in John's Gospel of another healing on a Sabbath that took place. We read about it back in chapter 5. Don't bother turning to it. Also on a Sabbath, in that case, this was a man who had a severe condition of paralysis. He'd been on his back for 38 years. Sabbath healing. Sabbath healing. Now, both of them are notable in the sense that they are extreme. It's like Jesus is picking out, we might say, the most hopeless cases of humanity. A man paralyzed for 38 years. A man not just blind, but born blind. Particularly sort of rubbing salt into the wounds of humanity. And it's like this paralyzed man in chapter 5 and the blind man here in chapter 9. they function as more than just a patient. Here is humanity in its natural state. In other words, blind from birth. And Jesus says, verse 3, it's not that this man sinned or his parents, but that the works of God might be displayed in him. You see, there was, in a sense, nothing especially deserving about his blindness. He hadn't sinned, his parents hadn't sinned, at least not any more than anyone else. And that's often a mistake that people make in this world, somehow linking a particular condition to some sort of sin that's happened. And Jesus knocks that on the head right here. His blindness and the healing which would shortly be given are there to teach the disciples, those around them, us as readers, something about God, something about humanity. And here we need to appreciate what humanity is really like, naturally speaking, spiritually speaking, blind from birth. I think that's quite a hard point to absorb and to really sort of let sink in. But just think about, you know, friends, family, colleagues that you've left at the sort of the open plan office or whatever it is, unable to help themselves spiritually. That's very important. As a blind man is unable to give himself sight, so our blind spiritual friends and family are unable to help themselves spiritually. And I think one of the big dangers that we as Christians have is forgetting how desperate the world's situation truly is. I mean, think about the world in which we live. People achieve remarkable things. And I think especially in the sort of work environments that most of you have come from just now, I think it's easy to be very optimistic about the world in which we live. We can be wooed, can't we, by people's sort of intellect or capabilities or achievements. You know, we often find ourselves saying, even amongst sort of quite keen churches, oh, so-and-so, he's got such an impressive career, such an incredible brain, such a high-powered whatever. The point we need to see here is humanity without Jesus, however high-powered and intellectual and capable the individual is, spiritually speaking, has no advantage over this man blind from birth. And so what we're seeing in this guy is not a sort of an unfortunate exception. He's exhibit A of the human condition, blind from birth. And Jesus says, we should expect to see, and about what's about to happen, we should expect to see the works of God displayed in him. It's going to take a miracle for sure. I mean, people blind from birth don't just suddenly see again. And that brings us to the second point. Jesus enables the man to see. Have a look at verse 6. Having said these things, he spat on the ground, made mud with his saliva, and then he anointed the man's eyes with the mud. Now, that's pretty weird stuff, isn't it? Be easy just to brush over that and say, I don't have a clue what that's about. Well, the truth is, I don't have a clue what that's about. But you won't be surprised to hear that I've done a little bit of speculating, a bit of thinking. You can be the judge of whether there's any weight in this. Let me tell you a few ideas that I don't think are right. Some have suggested the saliva has healing properties. Not so sure about that. A little bit speculative in my mind. Some think this is Jesus using creation symbolism in the same way that man was made from the dust of the earth. So Jesus uses the mud of the earth to make a new creation. Well, you could take that or leave that. I would suggest probably leave that one as well. Calvin suggests this. He says, to add mud to a man's eyes makes it even more impressive to then heal him. I think that's true, isn't it? That's just sort of logical. I think there's something more significant going on here. In the Old Testament, there's lots of emphasis on being holy, on being set apart. How do things get made holy, made set apart, made right with God? Well, people were either sort of clean or unclean, holy or unholy. And that included objects as well. If an unclean person was to touch, or even worse, a clean person, in the Old Testament it goes without exception, that person or that object would be made unclean too. But here's the fascinating thing. Jesus often took Old Testament principles and turned them on its head. Something Jesus does again and again and again. You see, the point of the Old Testament is that you could transfer a person's status by touch or by saliva. But I think what Jesus is doing is turning it on its head. So whereas mostly things would be made unclean, if it's Jesus, God incarnate, doing something, well, something could be made clean. And so I think what Jesus is doing is showing a transfer of a righteous status through the saliva, the bodily fluid, if you like. Well, like I said, it's a little bit of speculation, but I think there's a little bit more in terms of turning Old Testament customs on their head. Anyway, the point is it works. Verse 7, he said to them, go and wash in the pool of Siloam, which means sent. So he went, washed, came back seeing. What a day. I mean, what a day that must have been. I don't know if you've seen sort of reels where little children who obviously have got terrible sight suddenly have glasses put on and they sort of, you know, suddenly their whole world opens up and they're rather reluctant having these glasses forced on. And, you know, my kids send me that sort of stuff on Instagram and things, but it's so sweet to see, isn't it? Christian author Max Lucado, in one of his books, he writes the true story of a man called Bob Edens. He'd been blind for 51 years. His whole world was a black hole of sounds and smells. He felt his way through 5 decades of darkness. Skilled surgeon then performed a very complicated operation, and Bob Edens could see, and his testimony is wonderful. He said all these sort of things like, I can see for the first time the shape of the moon. It's been described to me so many times. Now I can see it. It's incredible. And then I love this. He says, I never would have dreamed that yellow is so yellow. I don't have the words. I'm amazed by yellow. Who knows what this man, born blind, must have said. The physical miracle is amazing, isn't it? I mean, Jesus really could, if Jesus was around today, I mean, he really could render the NHS redundant. But there is more going on here. You see, the real miracle is not his physical sight, but his spiritual enlightenment. And that's the thing the text homes in on. We don't get any of his testimony of, wow. Instead, we get what happens to him. You'll see the little subpoint there, the physical spiritual stuff. Yes, it's very much a physical healing. But unlike the healing in John 5, it stands in contrast. Here there is a spiritual dimension. There isn't in John 5. As we read on in chapter 9, we see his attitude changes. I think this is fascinating. We didn't have time to read the whole chapter. So just go through the text with me. I'll just draw your attention to a few clips of what happens to the man. Verse 11, as far as this guy who gets healed, what does he think about Jesus? Well, Jesus is just the man called Jesus. Anyone might say that. Look on to verse 17, bit of progress. The once blind man describes Jesus as a prophet. Well, that's definitely better than just a man. Small bit of progress. Look on to verse 33, though. He concludes in verse 33 that Jesus must be from God. And then verse 38, he accepts Jesus to be not just a prophet, not just from God, but much more, Lord, I believe, and he worships him in verse 38. No prophet would accept worship. I mean, to worship somebody, that means to throw yourself on the floor and give you a whole sort of devotion. You only do that to God. I mean, here he is converted. You see the change that's happened. Many will have heard the story of how C.S. Lewis, Clive Staples Lewis of Narnia fame, Mere Christianity, you might have read. His early adult life, when he started off very much an academic from the beginning, incredible brain, we could certainly say that of him at every stage. But his early life, he would, his own testimony, blinded by atheism and rationalism. That was the world in which he grew up. Then, encouraged by many friends, including prominent author Tolkien and others, he made some progress. By his own admission, he said, I moved from my atheistic worldview to a theistic one, believed that there was a God, not yet a Christian. And then finally, from Lewis's point of view, reluctantly, he surrendered his life. He became a Christian. You can read, it's a wonderful sort of story of how he became a Christian. You can read about it in one of his books, Surprised by Joy. And he writes this, that which I greatly feared had at last come upon me. I finally gave in and admitted that God was God. And I knelt and prayed, perhaps that night, the most dejected and reluctant convert in all of England. And the point being made in John, in just the same way that it takes a miracle to open somebody's eyes physically, so it takes a miracle to enable somebody to see spiritually, to convert somebody. And the passage doesn't use the word miracle. It uses this phrase, the works of God. Remember back in verse 3, the works of God. So what exactly are these works? I mean, clearly a physical healing is an impressive thing to do. We'd certainly be quite distracted if that sort of stuff was genuinely happening with reliable witnesses around us today. No human being can do stuff like that. Jesus draws attention through that to his divine identity, a man born from birth, a man blind from birth. But the work of God is concerned primarily not with the physical, but with the spiritual and the eternal. And it's actually much more impressive than the physical and temporal stuff. And John goes on to explain in the next few chapters of his gospel that this is work that, of course, the disciples will be involved in. They're going to write down the words that Jesus says, and these very words, the testimony of Jesus, will be used to bring about the spiritual sight. The very work that, of course, happens today. All the words that are needed to bring about the spiritual reality are found in the gospel as people get to know Jesus. And the point here is very simple. For people's eyes to be opened spiritually, it takes a miracle. It's not something that happens through intellectual capability. It requires a miracle. It doesn't matter how brilliantly the gospel is presented, how academic the presenter of the gospel is. Without Jesus conferring his clean status on those hearing the words, there's a supernatural act by God's Holy Spirit that needs to take place. Without that, there's no hope. You see, Jesus alone can switch the lights on in somebody's heart, somebody's mind. And so if you're somebody who actually just sort of thinks, well, I don't really get any of this. I don't really know what he's banging on about. I don't understand this. I don't get why people see Jesus as so important. The key thing that you need to do is ask Jesus for help. Of course, it also means admitting that you're blind. That's quite a humbling experience. To admit you're blind spiritually, that's an interesting starting point, isn't it? By extension. For many of us, of course, who believe, trusted in Jesus, I mean, this only acts as a core reminder. Only Jesus can open blind eyes. So where is our confidence being placed? We need to be praying for individuals to accept the testimony they hear. But let's just bring this to a bit of a close. You'll see the third and the final point laid out there. Spiritual sight changes a person. I think this is so interesting. Again, you know, we don't get the testimony of what this guy says about now being able to see. We get distracted with all of that stuff. Instead, what we get are details about the conversion experience and what a difference that makes. You see, conversion is not a private decision. It's a publicly recognizable one. The change that this man has gone through has been so dramatic that some people don't even recognize him. It's really interesting. Look at verse 6. The neighbors and those who had seen him before as a beggar were saying, "Is this not the man who used to sit and beg?" But some said, "Is it he?" Others said, "No, but it's like him." And he kept on saying, "I am the man. I am the guy that's had their eyes opened." Finally, look on to verse 25. He affirms this again. "One thing I do know, though I was blind, now I see." And the point is, when God works to convert, people will notice. It's not private. This change is profound. I mean, he started life as a beggar, and now, you know, even by the end of chapter 9, he's going head to head with the religious authorities. It's like he's got all the sort of bishops gathered round, and he's telling them off and correcting them. What a change from being somebody who just asked for coins on the edge of a street. He's now running circles around them. Look at verse 32. We'll pick up the sort of the end bit of his sort of diatribe against the religious authorities. And he says, "Look, never since the world began has it been heard that anyone opened the eyes of a man born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing." They answered him, "You were born in utter sin and you would teach us." And they cast him out. That means they excluded him from the synagogue. That would have removed access to all of the things in the Jewish community, like jobs and sort of being able to just sort of buy stuff in shops and that sort of thing. He was cast out. What an incredible change. Spiritual sight, converting people changes that person. This is a really, really important point. What that means, of course, is if we want to see this world in which we live change for the better, morally, socially, financially, whatever, then we're going to need to convert people. It's the only way you're going to see social change, useful social change. Tell them the gospel. Often William Wilberforce is spoken about in these sort of things, and he's such a good example. I mean, Wilberforce, as I'm sure you know, I mean, he was the man that was responsible, sort of politically speaking, for having slavery abolished. And he is very quick to credit that work to not his stuff said in Parliament, but to the Great Awakening. He said the country was prepared spiritually because they'd heard the gospel to make social change. It was only because of the gospel that had taken root in this country that social change was possible. And you see this in individuals, don't you? I mean, think of the Apostle Paul. Starts off life when he's called Saul, murders Christians, converted, protects Christians, apostle of Jesus. What a change. I love one of the stories that I love the most in terms of the way somebody has changed, the story of Nikki Cruz. If you've heard it before, it's so good. You can read about it in a couple of books. David Wilkinson's, he's the preacher. His own story is called The Cross and the Switchblade, or Nikki Cruz wrote his own testimony in Run, Baby, Run. They're really worth reading. Very simply, I mean, he was born into a Satanist family. He became the leader of one of the most feared gangs in New York, the Mau Maus. He caused absolute havoc in his early life. And one day, he meets a preacher called David Wilkinson. And the preacher told Cruz that God loved him, and Cruz hated it, threatened to kill him. 2 weeks later, the preacher had an evangelistic meeting in the neighborhood, and when Cruz heard about it, he decided that this was his opportunity to go and teach the preacher a lesson. And he went there. He was armed with a firebomb and a weapon. And when he arrived there, as he was making his way towards the preacher, he heard the words of the gospel, and he said everything changed. For the first time, he felt guilty about the things he had done. And he says he started to pray. And sometime after this, Cruz went to Bible school, and Cruz became a preacher. Many, many people became Christians as a result of this incredible change. But you see what brought about that change? It wasn't a social program. It was the gospel. When God works a miracle in someone, he will render that person unrecognizable. It's wonderful, isn't it? Gospel does that. So here is Jesus, the light of the world. Jesus really does bring light to the blind. But as we'll see next week, he also, rather alarmingly, blinds some people who can see. And we'll think more about that next week. So join us for that.